Some crimes are too terrible to put into words, like the killing in cold blood of 12,000 Polish soldiers in the Katyn Forest, just inside Russia in 1940. The film Katyn was shown in All Souls just about 10 days ago. Those 12,000 in the end soldiers, they were taken away in train trucks, torn from their families, almost all of them never to be seen alive again. The massacre that was to follow was not committed by one person out of control or by a gang. It was committed by a government, by a regime. Now, inevitably, and I hope this is the case, various questions go through our minds. What are my feelings when I see that? What does the Bible have to say about regimes that behave like that one? Is it right to call such regimes evil? If so, what are the characteristics of an evil regime? Or another question, where does God come in? Poland is not the only nation in history to be invaded, plundered by powerful neighbors with atrocities against defenseless citizens. The Jews were overcome by the mighty Babylonian army back in the 6th century BC. The city was razed to the ground and its people taken off into exile. One of those exiles was Daniel. He lived as an exile in Babylon, the setting for the book of Daniel that we have in front of us tonight. And this book was and is still a message for people who had lost. They'd lost their homes, their homeland, their families often, their dignity. Maybe tempted to wonder how much their faith and trust in God was worth. Now, when we open the pages of the Bible, we discover as we get to know it that the Bible has different ways of speaking. Always it is truth. Truth about human beings, truth about God. But sometimes it reads like a history book. In other places, as poetry. But here and sometimes in other places too, it presents truth in pictures. Ever since I was a teenager, one painting in particular, Guernica, by Pablo Picasso, has taught me, perhaps more than any book, about suffering inflicted on civilians in war. The painting, if you know it, you'll know that it's horrible, ugly, provocative, and compelling. Daniel 7 teaches us through pictures, not through an artist's painting, but through Daniel's dreams, his visions. And we call this kind of communication in the Bible, it has the term apocalyptic literature. And in this kind of literature, the pictures are a message about what will happen in the end. And yet the message is relevant now, and never more relevant than when God's people are struggling, suffering as a result of an evil regime. If you look down at the page, page 892, you'll see in the first verse, it says this, to introduce chapter 7. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying on his bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. Don't expect sweet dreams from Daniel. In fact, you could describe this one as, he would say, my worst nightmare. And so with the Bible in front of us, let's hear verses 2 to 8 read for us. It's Daniel's dream, scene 1.
So beginning verse 2, Daniel said, in my vision at night I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground, so that it stood on 2 feet like a man, and the heart of a man was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, get up and eat your fill of flesh. After that I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard. And on its back it had 4 wings like those of a bird. This beast had 4 heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a 4th beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them. And 3 of the first horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth that spoke boastfully.
Daniel certainly had a very bad night. Scene 1 of his dream focused on 4 big beasts. These animals, these 4 beasts, were not the cuddly variety that you buy in a pet shop. They were major, powerful animals, the kind we treat with fear and respect. A lion, a bear, a leopard, and finally this unnamed animal, beast number 4. But each of these animals in the dream had what I call extra features. The lion in verse 4 had the wings of an eagle to accentuate his majesty and strength. The bear in verse 5 was raised up, apparently to allow him to devour even more. The ribs wedged in his teeth were evidence of his last meal, and he was already licking his lips for his next fill of flesh. Then in verse 6, the leopard, already known for its ability to launch a surprise attack, the leopard was given added speed with the wings of a bird. While we're thinking a little bit about big animals, I'll talk about my own experience of one of them. In fact, one of my most scary moments ever was observing a rhino in the safari park in Kenya. The rhino was not too far away. But just then, our car got stuck in a ditch. And the 2 Kenyans with me wisely refused to get out to move it. So I did it by myself. And fortunately, although the rhino was probably looking through his binoculars at me, he didn't actually move. But with an animal like that, I shiver sometimes at what just might have happened. Though already there are clues as to what these great beasts stand for. The lion-eagle combination was used in Jeremiah to represent Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian emperor who smashed Jerusalem and carted off the Jews into exile. And as we read through these verses, it appears that these beasts have the stance or the heart or the eyes of a man. And it says of the leopard, it was given authority to rule. But if these first 3 beasts, the lion, the bear, and the leopard, paint pictures of human rulers of immense power and ambition, beast number 4 is in a league of its own. So we read a moment ago, after that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me, verse 7, was this 4th beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. Terrifying and frightening and very powerful. More cruel, more terrifying, more ruthless, more brutal than the others. It had big teeth, iron implants, and big feet, large enough to trample and crush whatever was left. Other features included these 10 horns instead of the usual 2, and this little horn, small but aggressive and arrogant, seizing power held by other rulers. We will hear more about the 4th beast later. But then, suddenly, between verse 8 and verse 9 of chapter 7, there's this dramatic scene change. And still in visionary mode, we are introduced to another side of the dream that we might call the dream ticket. Listen to find out who they were, these 2 figures, as we read and hear the content of this second scene described in verses 9 to 14.
As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but were allowed to live for a period of time. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed.
After the turbulent sea, from which there arose those four great beasts, we come to a completely different setting. This is heaven, where there is order and calm, where justice is carried out firmly but wisely, where evil is not in charge. And in this good heaven, we see two figures. The first figure is called the Ancient of Days. An ancient here doesn't really mean aged as much as ageless. With all the signs of wisdom and purity, the white clothes and the divine fire. And as we look at the Ancient of Days, we realize that we're in the presence of God himself. This image may at first sight look rather remote and out of touch with reality, but that's not the case at all. The Ancient of Days acts decisively in judgment. He is pictured destroying the fourth beast and defeating the others who survive for a time, but not forever. I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking, and I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. But there is another figure, the other part of the dream ticket, described as one like a son of man, or more simply, he looked like a man. He was not typical of the human beings that we meet every day, people like ourselves, flawed, mixture of good and bad. But he was human, as creation had intended humans to be. So much so that this man was worthy of the authority and power that he was given. Some human institutions can look very impregnable, airlines or oil companies or banks. And to look at some superpowers, we might feel the same. History tells us that even they can rise and fall. But the Son of Man became a term used by Jesus himself when he first came and then announced that he would come again. And his kingdom is described here, his powerful but just and gentle rule. His kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. What a contrast. When we're looking at the four beasts, they only fill us with fear. Yet in one visionary breath expressed in passing from verse 8 to verse 9, from scene 1 to scene 2 of the dream, there is the order and the goodness of heaven. And these two figures, pictured first as the Ancient of Days and one like a son of man. Now, normally when we wake from a dream, especially a nightmare, there is that sudden and wonderful wave of relief. We say to ourselves, I was only dreaming. But both in this dream and afterwards, Daniel knows that what he has witnessed in these graphic, dynamic, visionary pictures was in fact reality. In scene 1, grim reality. In scene 2, wonderful reality. But that is not the end of the story, because it says in verse 15 that I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit, and the visions that passed through my mind disturbed me. Daniel was determined to find out what it all meant, and we will do that with him now. The images that we saw right at the beginning, just a few 10 minutes ago, the images of Catan in the film, and also now these images of these beasts and the visions, they are real. But what do they have to tell us? Well, you can imagine Daniel as he looked at these saying, I'm not dreaming. Daniel was not just curious, he was troubled. This was not a dream he could dismiss or forget. He wanted answers, and so he says in verse 16 that I approached one of those standing there and asked him the true meaning of all this. In other words, explain these beasts. Now it doesn't take long until verse 17, in fact, where we get the short answer. The four great beasts, in the interpretation, it says that the four great beasts are four kingdoms that will rise from the earth. But Daniel is desperate to know particularly about beast number four, because he realized as he looked at him, he was the worst, not just in appearance. And like Daniel, we have our questions. At least I have a couple. This is the first of them. Question one, in what way was he worse? You can imagine those Jewish exiles. They couldn't have imagined a regime worse than the Babylonian Empire that had taken them into exile. But as Daniel looked, he saw that the fourth beast was even worse than that. And we see that particularly from verse 25. Let me read it. Verse 25 says about this fourth beast, he will speak against the Most High God, and oppress his saints and try to change the set times and the laws, and the saints will be handed over to him for a time, times and half a time. What is that saying? Well, he hates God. It's the first thing it's saying. He was speaking against the Most High, rejecting his authority, not just silently, but with blasphemy. And because he hated God, so he hated God's people. He targeted them, oppressing them. And that led, in terms of, obviously, to the next point, that he eradicated, or wanted to, tried to eradicate all reminders of God. There was this ruthless attempt to remove all links to God, trying to change the set times and the festivals and the laws. Now, when we see that happening in our own days, we realize that this is either secularization or perhaps an attempt to impose another religion. And then this culminated, as it says, in possessing God's people for a period of time. How strange that it says that. The saints will be handed over to him for a time, times, and half a time. It's chilling. But fortunately, that is not the end of the story. Now, we're bound to ask as we look at these things back in Daniel's day, is this happening now? Now, from what I hear from friends in All Souls in other countries, the position is much more serious than it is here in the United Kingdom. There could be a complete government clampdown. Persecution is being intensified in some nations that are represented here this evening, no doubt. By comparison, we in the United Kingdom, we have many freedoms still, and the gospel has not been outlawed. And yet, there are these smaller signs of pressure, of ridicule, of law change, of change in public opinion. Just reading the other day that Porteous Wood, executive director of the National Secular Society, claimed, he said, the gulf between the views of the churches and the population as a whole is growing. Now, it's difficult to argue with that. And as we think about our own lives, we all have our experience of where we feel the impact of that growing change. Perhaps we think about work or home even, or wherever it is, we feel that hostility towards us. And it comes because we are ourselves followers of Christ, and other people don't like that. But I have another question as I look at these verses here. What kingdoms do these beasts represent? Do we know? There's been a huge amount of debate about this, and it could take a very long time. It's just going to take a very short time. There is, first of all, as people look at these kingdoms, these beasts, the historic set. In other words, if the lion is the Babylonian Empire, then it suggests that the Medes and the Persians who came next are represented by the bear, and then the Greeks, the leopard, and number four equals the Roman Empire. And certainly when we get to Revelation, Rome is very clearly the central beast when it's talking about the situation there. So as the historic set, there's also what you might call the speculative suggestions. When Napoleon was at his height, there were people in this country who thought that he was the beast. And when the common market had 10 members, like the 10 horns, those unsympathetic observers wondered if this connected with those 10 horns of the beast. Now, it's very difficult for people to say. It is speculative. And the commentator Wallace has pointed out that it's not difficult with a little ingenuity to fit them into some historical pattern of evil. But then we go on, and perhaps it speaks to us mainly about evil regimes in general. Now, it's not always wise to jump to conclusions too quickly and name names. The current perception may not in time prove to be entirely the right one. It is too easy to make sweeping statements about which regime is evil and which isn't, although it can be a very popular headline to do that. But in the cold light of day, perhaps Cambodia would seem, or seemed from the past, to have some of those hallmarks during the Pol Pot regime. What are those characteristics? Well, according to Daniel 7, the characteristics of an evil regime like the fourth beast were cruelty and arrogance and persecution. The fourth beast here shows extreme cruelty, appalling arrogance, and a desire to annihilate anyone, any mass of people perceived as opposition, as unwelcome or as a nuisance. Cruelty, arrogance, persecution, sometimes the persecution practice as annihilation or eradication. Bernard Levin wrote in The Times in April 1976, he wrote this, "Cambodia has achieved a distinction which has so far eluded even those countries unfortunate enough to experience the full weight of terror brought to bear by even the most monstrous tyrants of our time. It is the first country to be transformed into a concentration camp in its entirety. In Cambodia, ignored by the outside world, as we realize now that largely it was, in Cambodia, the unburied dead cry for vengeance and the living dead for pity and cry both in vain." Cambodia could be one example when an evil regime takes charge, but it is certainly not the only example. And we should hesitate to point to the finger just at others. I can think of ways in which Britain has perhaps not managed to use its responsibilities satisfactorily, and where others have suffered greatly as a result. But as I said earlier, that's not the end of the story, because alongside the horror nightmare, there is a dream come true. Because as we look through the explanation of what these beasts were all about, from time to time in verse 18, verse 22 it is, and then when we get to verses 26 to 27, the interpreter spells out what God painted in the vision as the Ancient of Days and the one like a son of man. It paints what God has done and will do. And where they sit is in the highest court of justice. And in the end, the judgment that they bring is the one that counts. "Tell me the ending," you can imagine Daniel saying. And that's what we have in verses 26 and 27. The exiles in Babylon at that time needed to hear this. "The court will sit and his power will be taken away, the beast's power, and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be handed over to the saints, the people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him." What was given to the Son of Man, as we saw in verse 14, is promised to the people of God, the saints of the Most High. And we're left in no doubt at all who is ultimately in charge. It tells us that God is in control. Now that little phrase, "God is in control," can be one of those statements that slips easily off the tongue to provide a ready answer to any difficult or complicated situation. Certainly here it is not used in that way. It's not used about the details of our lives here, like the weather or our diary for the week and so on. Here it is a statement about the really big picture. And what it is not saying when it says that God is in control, it's not saying that God in control makes our life simple. Daniel knew that. He worked for the government. That was complicated, working for the Babylonian government. We may have our own version of complications, working in situations where we feel uncomfortable. Daniel must have found his life hard, not just in terms of physical threat. He had to learn not to compromise without having to withdraw. Knowing God was in control didn't make his life straightforward. So how does that message that we see in front of us here, right through this particular chapter, that God is in control, how does that message work in practice? It's very interesting to look at the very last verse here, verse 28. It's a bit of a surprise. It's a verse that can easily get missed, but it is interesting. It's interesting because Daniel was hardly a weakling when it came to faith in God. And yet it says in verse 28, even after Daniel had heard those amazingly strong promises, it says that Daniel was still deeply troubled. Let me read that verse. This is the end of the matter. "I, Daniel, was deeply troubled by my thoughts, and my face turned pale, but I kept the matter to myself." He was troubled, troubled because he wasn't pretending. Daniel's faith wasn't an escaping faith. His vision of these ambitious rulers, and especially of the evil regimes highlighted by the fourth beast, they showed him what we all need to see. The world can carry a great burden of evil. And the Christian is taught to take it in, to ask questions, to avoid simplistic answers. The writer, Christian writer Oswald Chambers said this, I think some words to go away and think about. Unless we can look the darkest fact full in the face without damaging God's character, we do not yet know him. So he was deeply troubled, but at the same time profoundly reassured. We assume that from what he had heard and his decision to persevere as he did. And Daniel 7 presents the worst about human cruelty and potential for evil. There it is. It's here in front of us. But we don't need to be absorbed by the horror of Katyn. We do need to face those realities, though, and handle them as Christians day by day in a changing world, climate, and culture. And when we do that, we're not on our own. As we heard earlier, sung for us, all over the world, people are following Jesus. There's no reason for us to lose heart. But as looking at these realities, at the same time, God knows that we need constant reminders that he is Lord. And that whatever happens, we are his. He is Lord, and we are his. His is the kingdom that never ends. And when we come to Christ and enter his kingdom, we are ultimately and comprehensively, as followers of Christ, under his authority and secure in him. That's what it means to know that God is in control. When we look around, we don't see all the signs of the battle that Christ fought having been won, but we know the battle has been won. And whatever the circumstances, we look always to Jesus Christ, the Son of Man. That's how we live with the hostility of the world that we feel sometimes so much. The writer to the Hebrews in one place said this, let us fix our eyes on Jesus. That was his recommendation. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful people so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. And then, as we see earlier in that book of Hebrews, we do not see everything subject to him. At present, says the writer of the Hebrews, we do not see everything subject to him, but we do see Jesus.